This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Cleveland, Ohio, where we're broadcasting today from the studios of member station WCPN. Brook Park is an industrial suburb just beyond the city limits of Cleveland, a community of modest, well-maintained houses just 20 minutes' drive from downtown. The city of 21,000 people is home to a Ford engine plant, a NASA facility, Cleveland's airport, a gigantic convention center located in an old tank factory, a National Guard armory, and the headquarters of a battalion of Marine Corps reserves, the 3rd Battalion of the 25th Regiment. In the course of one terrible week in August 2005, 19 Marines from the 3rd to the 25th were killed in Iraq. Over the course of the entire war, the death toll in this one battalion is 48. Young men from many communities, but Brook Park is the epicenter of the grief and the loss. As we approach the 4th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, we come to Northern Ohio to talk about the cost of war with the father of one of the Marines killed in the Euphrates Valley a year and a half ago, with a Marine who was severely wounded that week, and with an employer who copes with the absences of some of his key workers when they're called back to duty. Later in the program, we'll talk with Salim Amir in Baghdad about what this anniversary means to one Iraqi. But first, Brook Park, Ohio. If you have questions for our guest about their experiences, give us a call. We also want to know how the war has affected your town or city, your company, and your family. Our number, as always, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our first guest is Paul Montgomery. He lives about 12 miles from here in the city of Willoughby. His son, Marine Lance Corporal Brian Montgomery, was killed August 1st, 2005, near Haditha, along with five of his fellow Marines. It's nice to have you on the program. Our condolences for your loss.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Tell us a little bit about your son, Brian.
Well, Brian was a... In fact, the little clip that I heard by Augie Schroeder's stepmother... Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Brian. He also loved that song, I Love This Bar. He had a favorite bar. He was just a very happy person. Every picture I've ever seen him in, he's got a smile. His good nature was contagious. From some of the people that I've talked to who served with him in Iraq, they said he always had a smile on his face. When people were feeling a little down, when morale was a little low, he was always there to liven things up a little bit. He was just, a pleasure to be around. He was a bit of an entrepreneur. He had two of his own businesses. The one business he had just opened a month before he shipped out for Iraq. He was just, I remember him just with a big smile on his face.
So it's the loss of a son. It's the loss of a businessman who might now be employing a bunch of other people here in Northern Ohio. It's a loss for the community.
That's very true. Brian was very much involved with the community. He was good friends with the mayor of Willoughby, with all of the police, all of the firemen. He was just a good community citizen.
His brother Eric served in that same battalion on that same deployment.
Yes, he did. In fact, Eric was attending college at the time, and when Brian had found out that they were going to be deployed, or there was a possibility that they would be deployed, Eric left school, joined the Marines, went through boot camp, went through his training, and signed up with 325 so that they could deploy together. Mm-hmm. And they really... You know, some people feel that, how could I handle having two sons in the same place? But to a large extent, that was such a blessing because I believe those two boys got to know each other so much better than they ever could have. And they were there to support each other and understand each other.
Some long nights for their parents, though.
Yeah. You mean before they went?
Mm-hmm. And while they were there.
And while they were there, yeah. I mean, they again, I'm sure they discussed family and such. And I mean, it was nice to hear from them when I would, as far as getting letters or hearing from them on the phone. But you know, I don't know that I worried any more because I had two there than because I had one. I mean, each one was just as precious to me.
Sure. Your son Eric, now in the Naval Academy.
Yes, he when he got back from Iraq, he started back to school at Ohio University and decided that just wasn't for him. He applied to the Naval Academy. He's in his plebe year. And he's doing very well. His grades are excellent. All of his marks are excellent. He's, like I say, he's doing very well, and he has his sights set on he will be a Marine officer.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Rick Turner is 22 years old. Just over a year and a half ago, he was on duty in Iraq, serving in the same unit as Brian Montgomery when a suicide car bomb exploded just a few feet away from him. 10 surgeries later, Rick Turner is on the mend. He's with us here at the studios of WCPN today. Nice to have you on the program.
It's nice to be here.
And I have to ask you, how you doing?
I'm doing a lot better than I was. Way better.
It cost you, among other things, an eye.
Yeah. Yes. It. Not only did I lose my eye, I lost some feeling in my right leg. I got other wounds as far as my wrist. I got plates in my wrist. Not only my body, though, just mental damage of knowing that I had friends there serving with that are not only injured also, but that aren't here with us anymore.
Yeah, you were at the time on a mission to look for one of the Marines who was killed that day. His body was not with the five others who were found. He was later found dead. But that's a mission that's so important to the Marine Corps. No man left behind.
Right. We were actually sitting in an observation post watching for mortars coming downrange that were hitting our camp. And we got the call earlier in the morning, and we just happened to hear it over battalion. And it kind of hit us pretty hard.
Hmm. You know? Now, you've been in and out of hospitals. We mentioned all those surgeries, and you still got some more to go, I assume.
No, actually, I'm all through with all my surgeries. I'm just on the road to recovery, and as far as I know and the way I feel is probably back to as close to 100% as I can be, you know, to the best of my ability.
You wanted to be a police officer before you went. Is that going to still be possible for you?
I'm not sure. I'm still, I don't know. I'm kind of looking into it. I don't know if they'll let me just because I can't run. I can't do the physical agility. I don't think I can run a mile and a half in 11 minutes.
That's the hurdle you have to, the barrier you have to reach?
Right. I was told even by in the Marine Corps that losing my eye doesn't make me, you know, any less of a Marine or that I can't do my duty. I can still fire my weapon, but I just can't run. I have no agility.
Hmm. As you look ahead, there have been so many like you, other men who have been injured, some worse than you. Obviously, as you mentioned, some people, like your friend, aren't coming back. What has this meant to your community, to the people? I mean, you know so many of these people so well.
Right. It hit everybody really hard. I've talked to a lot of people that they just want to thank us, and it means a lot. You know, coming home to everybody basically with open arms. Everyone is ready to receive us in open arms and just, you know, be there for us.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. If you'd like to join us, by the way, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email again, talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can begin with Caleb. Caleb with us from Ames, Iowa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to get your guests' reactions to a phenomenon that I've experienced. I served in the U.S. Navy with special warfare at the beginning of the Iraq War and made it back fine without injury. But since I've been back, I've experienced some guilt over the fact that I was uninjured and so many of, you know, friends and acquaintances weren't. And I was wondering... particularly with respect to those who didn't make it back at all. And I was wondering if your guests could speak to that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, Caleb. Rick Turner, did you want to try that?
Sure. I actually sometimes I do feel a little bit of guilt that I was able to come home and be with my family, and that so many in my battalion were not able to. Sometimes I feel like if I could have done something different, or if you know, the Marines that were with me, or if we could have just made a different call, had better judgment about anything that happened over there. Sometimes I do think about it. I wonder what if.
This is known as survivor guilt. Paul Montgomery, I wonder what your reaction is to this. Of course, you lost your son.
Well, and I guess I have a little bit different perspective than some of the people who have lost their children in Iraq, because my other son was over there, and I know when he came back, he I'm sure felt some guilt. I'm sure he had trouble expressing that, but I know, you know, he had said that he was sorry that he had let me down, that he didn't bring his brother home. But, you know, I mean, I think that's something that you work through. I think that's something that's natural to feel. I know as a parent who lost someone, I felt like, why couldn't it be me? And that's not necessarily survivor's guilt, I don't think. But yeah, I think that's something that a parent will do for their child. I would gladly have traded places with my son.
And I assume, Rick Turner, you would have traded places with some of the men who did get killed. I mean, that's what you're there for. You back each other up.
Right. I was there 100% for everyone there. Whether or not you like somebody or you get along with somebody, you're all brothers, and you will have their back, and, you know, especially in a time of war. And, yeah, of course. I mean, there's times where I actually went down and I visited a Marine, Sergeant Graham. I visited his family in Oklahoma once I came back. And seeing his wife and his kids and his mom and his dad, just made me think, you know, he had so much more than me at the time. You know, why did it have to be him?
Rick Turner, former Marine Lance Corporal from the 3rd Battalion of the 25th Marine Regiment in Brook Park, Ohio. Also with us, Paul Montgomery, the father of Marine Lance Corporal Brian Montgomery, who was killed in Haditha in Iraq a year and a half ago. We're going to take a short break. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan with you today from the studios of member station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. The fourth anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq arrives next week. Today we're talking about that war and its impact on our lives. In a few minutes, we're also going to be hearing from an Iraqi about how he looks at this anniversary. Still with us in the studio are Paul Montgomery. His son was killed by Iraqi insurgents in 2005. And Rick Turner, a Marine Lance Corporal who survived a suicide bomber attack in 2005 but was left blind in one eye. You're welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. How has the war affected your town and your life? Rick Turner, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned briefly in the previous segment that people have been very supportive of you when you came, since you've been back. Tell us a little bit more about that. I know so many people, there's such a disconnect between what's going on in life right outside this radio studio, the people going shopping, going about their daily lives, and you know what's going on in Baghdad and Balad and Haditha today.
It's a little bit of everywhere. I can be in a supermarket and, you know, someone can notice my eye and they might ask me a question, or people who know, is acquaintance or know something about me, you know, they'll just come up and they'll just want to thank me. They'll want to shake my hand, and it's very supportive, you know. Pretty much, I don't know. I think everyone has it in the back of their mind. A lot of times they don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what to do to, you know, they might not know how to talk about it. They might not know much about it. And some people just want to learn a little bit more about it, what's going on over there. So they just want to come up and have a general conversation with you.
Mm-hmm. Paul Montgomery, do you sometimes feel like the men fighting over there are forgotten?
Well, I can't. It's hard to speak for the majority of the population.
Sure.
I will say this: at Brian's funeral, there was a procession lining the road for 26 miles. So people came out of nursing homes. People came out of my doctor's office shut down so that everyone could come out as the hearse passed. So people remember. Communities remember. I think even – now, I travel quite a bit, and I know when I see anyone in the service in an airport, if they're sitting in a bar, I'll put a 20 on the bar to buy them a round of drinks. Or, you know, if nothing else, if I'm just passing by, I make sure that I stop and thank them for their service. And I see other people doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hope they're not forgotten. I know there's – a lot of people who are caught up in their own lives and don't pay that much attention. But there are a lot of us out there who are very grateful for what all these guys have done for us and are still doing for mm-hmm. us.
Rick Turner?
Just as Paul said, you know, about the procession line being 26 miles long, there has been other Marines' funerals that have the same thing. Here in Northeast Ohio, I don't know about any other states or other regions of Ohio, but here in Northeast Ohio is very supportive. I have not met one single person that is opposed to us or you know, doesn't think about the way we feel or what happened over there.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Stephanie. Stephanie with us from Wichita, Kansas.
Hello, how are you guys doing? And thank you very much for everything that you have done for soldiers like my husband that are over there right now.
I think she's talking to you guys and not to me, but go ahead, Stephanie.
Well, my husband is a pilot in the Air Force, and he just got back from deployment, and he has been going through the same thing. He was an enlisted member of the Army before, and he has so much guilt that he's up in the air now and not on the ground, helping everyone else where he feels like he should belong sometimes.
And what do you tell him when he confesses these feelings to you?
I tell him that I'm proud of him, that everyone's proud of him, that we're so blessed to have communities and people around us that go out of their way to support the military and the soldiers. Everyone has different opinions on the war in Iraq, but that's one of the blessings of this war as opposed to, unfortunately, Vietnam. We have support. The soldiers and families aren't blamed for what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Paul Montgomery, I think you're old enough to remember Vietnam days.
Yes, I am. And I will say this. First of all, thank your husband very much for his service. I'd also, my younger son, who did return from Iraq, was trained as a radio operator originally. But, of course, every Marine is a rifleman, so he was out on patrols. But I know he typically had the radio with him, and there were more than a few times where he had to call in close air support. And believe me, he was very grateful for the guys in the sky who could come in very quickly and get them out of hot water. So, again, thank your husband very much for all of us.
Stephanie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get – if I can work this button. Matt. Matt's with us from Georgia.
Oh, hi. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to thank your guest for his service. I'm a former Marine, and I'm actually a National Guard infantry officer, and I was fortunate enough to get sent to Kosovo instead of Iraq last year. And I feel really blessed that I'm home with my family and with my sons, and that they made this sacrifice for guys like myself.
Matt, I can hear the emotion in your voice. This means a lot to you.
Absolutely.
Rick, I think he was speaking particularly to you.
Yeah, I have two boys myself, and I couldn't imagine if I wasn't here for them or if I didn't have an opportunity. Actually, I had a son when I came home. And if I didn't come home, he wouldn't be here.
7 months old now.
Yes, he's 7 months old, and his name's Owen. And Jordan, he's four.
Hmm. Well, Matt, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Have a great day, guys.
Bye-bye. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us is Ryan Fiorito. He's president of Tenable Protective Services. They provide security services to companies and organizations in Ohio and Michigan. He's also with us here in the studios of WCPN. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Now, you have quite a few employees who are members of the National Guard or members of the reserves. Is it possible? How does this affect your business? How does this affect what you do for a living?
It affects us on various levels, and it depends on where their position is within the company. But ultimately, it's from the standpoint of you need to realize overall what these employees are doing for the betterment of everybody. And it's a personal sacrifice that they're doing, and we look at just giving back to them and the rest of the country by what we do. So ultimately, it is a sacrifice from our end, but I think it's a very minimal sacrifice compared to what they're doing. So, you know, from our standpoint, it's just getting everything together and really helping as much as possible. So the short answer is it does affect us, but, you know, it's the least we could do in some of the items that we do for them.
There was an anonymous survey of employers conducted on the Internet, so they didn't have to say who they were. But I think over 50% said, given the situation, given the disruption that this can cause their company, they would prefer not to hire members of the National Guard or the Reserves.
And I did read quite a bit of documentation, and there are some items out there that suggest that, certainly. And you know, from our perspective, these individuals fit very well into what we do as a company. And again, their military background and how we operate in a paramilitary fashion, it really fits together. They're very well organized, the uniformity, and you know, that background that they have really does possess very well into what we're trying to do.
One of your employees, though, as I understand, have been called up three times and been deployed to Iraq. A, how does this affect your company if this is a key employee? B, you look at his career, and what does this do for him?
Being a two-part answer, first of all, what it does for our company, this gentleman is an executive within our company, our chief counsel, and you know, oversees some of the human resources functions. That obviously puts a strain on our resources.
An easy person to replace.
He's not an easy person. That's a professional service individual that has a lot of knowledge and insight. But, you know, to his credit, he assisted in aligning an individual to bring in after his departure, and each time we kind of picked up those pieces and moved on, and it's about our planning outside of just the normal contingency planning. But that is tough, yeah, without a doubt.
And every time, I assume you look and you say, again?
Again. Absolutely true. Again.
Yeah, again. And obviously, you know, Rick Turner, this has affected your life and your career even more directly than these employees. But as you look at this disruptions, you are a reservist. You were called up to duty, citizen soldier.
Yeah, I looked at it as an opportunity to serve my country. I was kind of in and out of jobs, and it was a great honor. I'd rather do that than bounce around and from job to job.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is, if we can get it to go, there we go, Edward. Edward with us from San Antonio.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to thank you, gentlemen, for serving. It seems such an odd phrase nowadays. I'm retired 21 years Ranger, and I was in Vietnam and Panama in the first Desert Storm. And I recall that people weren't aware of us, per se, of soldiers, of feelings, of things, you know, National Guard were looked down on, and, oh, you know, the guy's going to be gone a weekend or something. But I think this war has brought soldiers and what they do and all the sacrifices that they make to the forefront. Everybody's more aware. And it's really pleasant to have people that knew me for years and years, finally they're like, whoa, thank you for serving. Thank you for, you know, the things that you did. And I would like to thank you guys. I lost a lot of friends there, and I know that you have this feeling of remorse that you may get back, and I dealt with that for many, many years, and it's really hard.
It doesn't go away, does it, Edward? Do you remember moments? They're still vivid in your mind.
Oh, absolutely. We were in a 23-man team, and I'm the only one that made it back out of that original 23. So the nightmares They don't come as often, but they still come.
Rick, do you have nightmares?
Fortunately, I haven't had any so far. But I was told by the doctors that they could come in the years to come. So,
well, there's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Edward, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you guys again. I appreciate it.
We're speaking with three people from northern Ohio about the losses in war. Rick Turner, who was severely injured in Iraq. Paul Montgomery, whose son, Lance Corporal Brian Montgomery, was killed. And with also, this is Rick Ryan Fiorito, who's the president of Tenable Protective Services, who's lost several employees to service, not yet to been killed in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's turn now to, this is Vicki. Vicki with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi. Mr. Montgomery, my question is from a parent's point of view. My youngest son will be headed to Iraq toward the end of April or beginning of May. How do you deal with what the newscasting, and I'll be honest, my alarm is sent to NPR every morning, and how do you deal with that? I mean, how did you deal with hearing that every day and still going through your day as though everything was normal?
Well, to be perfectly honest, every day is not normal. Every day I kept my I have a home office, and every day I kept my television on Fox News and watched what was going on, and prayed and hoped that the phone wouldn't ring. And that's all you can really do. You just pray that they'll be okay and trust them that they know what they're doing and that they've been well trained and that they that they're there for a purpose, for a reason. When my son went over there, he you know, in fact, they both felt that, that their country had been attacked and that they had had a pretty good life up to that point, and it was time to give back. And so just the fact that they felt so strongly about what they were doing and doing the right thing, that's what kept me going, that they were doing the right thing. And like I say, you just pray.
Okay.
Vicki, we wish your son the best.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email question. Jane from North Carolina, a question for Rick. How well is the Veterans Affairs Office serving Rick to help him transition to a new profession since he's no longer physically capable of doing his job? While it's wonderful people are so supportive and thankful for his service, I can only imagine the pain of having to divorce himself from the core community. From my experience as an ex-naval officer, if you've set your sights on a long military career, anything less must be difficult to deal with.
Well, as far as the VA goes, as far as trying to find a job, they're kind of slow in the process. Some of it's they leave part of it up to you to get some information and basically get out there and search what you want to do, and then you leave the rest in their hands. And sometimes they're backed up, and with this war going on now, with so many injured coming home, you know, looking for help and wars previous, sometimes it's hard.
Hmm. Ryan Fiorito, let me ask you. We mentioned earlier some employers expressed doubts about hiring people in the Guard and Reserves because of the possible disruption. Given your line of business, would you be looking for veterans especially to hire?
We do, and we hire veterans. We hire individuals that are in the reserve, and again, it's because of what I said earlier. They have a valuable experience that does translate over to our core book of business, and, In Rick's case, we would employ him in a position as well because of his past training, his attention to detail and whatnot, because they generally suit what we're looking for. Again, that uniformity, that that core belief of belonging to a team, and that's really what these individuals do. It is like a small police department, in many different levels, individuals that work at the stadiums that we do, that work on the road. They all have that common, we look after each other. approach. So a lot of that transcends directly to what we do, and that's why they are valuable as employees and associates to our company.
And briefly, I didn't mean to speak for you earlier. I honestly don't know. Have any of your employees been injured or killed in tour of duty?
We did have one in Detroit, Michigan that was killed. He had been with us for a very short period of time, but he was back in, I believe it was 2002. Hmm.
We're going to have to take another short break. Stay with us, if you will. We're speaking with Ryan Fiorito, with Rick Turner, and with Paul Montgomery. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from Cleveland, Ohio, at the studios of member station WCPN. And here are headlines from some of the stories we're following here today at NPR News. The Senate Judiciary Committee has cleared the way for subpoenas that would compel five Justice Department officials to testify about the dismissal of six U.S. attorneys they fired. The ensuing controversy has prompted demands for the resignation of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And a new study in the journal Science suggests that autism can be caused by a mutation in one of any more than 100 genes. The study is one of several new reports on autism in recent months, which have shown the disease is far more common and far more complex than many experts had believed. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with a look at the HPV vaccine and whether it should be mandatory. Should parents be required to vaccinate their daughters against a sexually transmitted disease? Plus, the United Kingdom's new plan to deal with climate change. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. With us here in the studio at WCPN, Rick Turner, former Marine Lance Corporal who was injured in Iraq. Paul Montgomery, the father of Marine Lance Corporal Brian Montgomery, who was killed in Iraq a year and a half ago. Also, Ryan Fiorito, president of Tenable Protective Services. Several employees have been called up as members of the Guard and Reserves. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. How is the war affecting your town, your city, your life? With us now on the line is Andrew. Andrew calling us from Chicago.
Yeah, hi, Neil. I love your show, first of all.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks to both of you gentlemen for your service. I have to say the war in the most real sense isn't affecting me or my family or the people I know at all. I live in Chicago. It's a big city. And what I mean by most real ways is that I don't know anyone that's actually serving, and I don't know a lot of people that know people that are serving. And it's an odd situation in that sense, except that I feel that there's no one that I know that also is not aware on a daily basis of the service and sacrifice of our men and women over there. So in the sense that I'm not affected personally by it, I still think it's on the minds probably of every citizen of this country every day, and we're thinking about our soldiers there.
Paul Montgomery, I wonder how you respond to that.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are not directly affected by things. I don't know what the percentage of men serving versus the percentage of men available to serve is, or men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone that I've talked to that has served is, at least in my opinion, sort of a special person. And they many times they get characterized as they're only in the military because they need a way to pay for school.
Mm-hmm.
My son owned two businesses. He didn't need a way to pay for school. But like I say, I think at least all the people that I've met are special people because they feel that they have been privileged to live in this country, that their country was attacked, and now it's time to give something back. And so not everyone is going to feel that call. I think a large part of the reason my son felt that call was because he had a newborn son, my grandson, and he wanted to make sure that, or he wanted to try to make sure that his son would never have to serve, that if he could help resolve the problems of today, his son may not have to face those. So like I say, I mean, I can understand where there's a lot of people who just wouldn't be directly affected.
Thanks for the call, Andrew.
If I may say, it's that we're not directly affected except for exactly the points that your guest was just saying, is that I think that is affecting everyone around us because of, you know, what's happening, the causes of it, and it's on our minds, and it's something that I think has to be respected, even by those that totally oppose the war. I think they're still on board because of exactly those things that your guest just said, Mr. Montgomery.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, and I would agree that, that like you say, that sort of service does have to be respected, and I'm glad to hear that there are a lot of people out there who, even if they aren't directly involved, are still indirectly affected and do respect what these guys do.
Again, Andrew, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to, okay, there we go, Bill. Bill is with us from Connecticut.
Hi, how you doing, Neil? Thanks for your
I'm well, thank
our
you.
Nation.
Oh, well, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm a National Guard soldier. I joined after 9/11 as an older citizen, and I volunteered three times to deploy for the invasion of Iraq and ended up in Afghanistan. And served, I did my year over there. I have two sons. I ended up divorced as part of the deployment. You know, that was maybe already going, but we all, half the guys in my unit ended up divorced due to our deployment. Came home, went back to work. I worked for the government as a, you know, civil employee of the government and was asked to come back early to work. I had 90 days to, you know, resettle, and I went back to work, and there was just no understanding of what I was going through as a person after all I had been through. I was expected to just come back to work, jump right in, and be as 100% effective as I was before I left, and there seemed no room for everything I went through.
I guess, Ryan Fiorito, I'll ask you to respond to that. When men come back, or men or women come back and rejoin the workforce, do you expect them to be back up and running up to full speed immediately?
No. And we understand that there's that separation point that needs to take place as well. And for that, I think our human resources individuals have structured a pretty good system to put things back to perspective for them and to assist them getting back into, you know, what it is that they left from their employer. And you know, one of the things is that we hold their positions for them, and we do establish counseling. You know, every individual has that ability to go to an EAP-type program and, you know, get some necessary health and welfare from our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what's out there from the Veterans Department, but certainly we go through with everything and saying that, you know, we need to get these people back up. How can we assist them?
Hmm.
You know, how can we make them whole?
Rick, I wonder what you make of Bill's experience.
I can't really touch on his exactly, just because I was affected in a different way.
Sure.
I couldn't get back up right away. There was it's just a different situation. I think the way some people look at it is that either you're a Marine, soldier, sailor, whatever you are in the military, that you're trained basically to be a rock. You're not a rock as being stupid, but as being able to take each situation, assess it, and jump into it.
Hmm.
I think you're just, people look up to you as far as knowing that you're dependable and that you're going to be there. I think that's that might be the cause, that might be the reason, but I don't know.
Bill, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you. I wanted to end with this email that we have. This is from Marion. I am the mother of three teenage boys, and I vigorously protested this war. I do, however, want to go on record as one of the many, many Americans who are deeply appreciative of the sacrifice of our soldiers, their families, and their communities have made for all of us. To the father of the dead soldier, please know our family is deeply grateful, and we pray daily for you. One of the exercises we do as a family while we protest the war is to read the bios of the soldiers that have died so that we can honor them. And I guess we'll end it there. I should note that Paul Montgomery brought a picture of his son with him into the studio. We thank him for giving us some visual evidence. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And also like to thank Rick Turner, who was with us here in the studios at WCPN. Rick, good luck. And you're going to throw out the first pitch on opening day for the Indians?
Yes, I am.
Make sure it's a good, strong warm-up underneath the stands ahead of time. And also our thanks to Ryan Fiorito, president of Tenable Protective Services, for taking time out of his busy day to join us.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be right back after this. Of course, people in Iraq live with the violence and disruption of the war every day. Joining us now is Salim Amir. He's a member of NPR's Iraqi staff in Baghdad. You might remember hearing his wife recently gave birth to a new baby boy. As he told us on Morning Edition in January, raising a family in Iraq can be a challenge.
I'm happy to be the father of a beautiful child. I always find comfort looking at his face and tiny body. But our life is so complicated. How can I ensure he will have a peaceful life? Am I asking too much? The slightest movement from my child drives away any worry I have about our uncertain future. And the future here means a month at most. A day in Iraq at war is like a year in peacetime.
Salim Amir, one of NPR's Iraqi staff members in Baghdad. He joins us today on a satellite phone from Baghdad. And Salim Amir, thanks very much for staying up late at night there to speak with us.
Thank you, Neil.
And I have to ask, how's your son Youssef doing?
Well, he's doing okay, you know, despite the explosions next by the home.
Explosions are just a part of his daily life, I suspect.
Well, you know, we have IEDs went off on Americans, we have IEDs targeted Iraqi forces, and we have just random mortars here in the neighborhood, so that's what we are facing nowadays.
And your wife, is she doing well as well?
Well, she's okay, but she's insisting on me on quitting the job and getting back home, you know, and, you know, I have two choices, or stay at home or leave the country, Syria or Jordan.
A lot of your friends, have they left the country to go to Syria or Jordan just to get out of the way of the war? Go ahead.
Majority of my friends just left the country. But now we are facing, you know, a lot of difficulties, like getting the new G passport that just get issued. And, you know, you should pay bribe and you should stay for 2 months to get the passport. And then you're going to use the land ways to get to Syria or Jordan and, you know, that means that you're going to pass in the Sunni insurgents' strongholds.
Tell us, you work for an American company. Does that mean your life is at risk?
Well, of course it's risk. You know, just mentioning that, you know, and not just American, just a foreign, just Arabian, you know, news channel or just company, it's going to put your life at risk. And without anything, you know, just civilian, just regular people, they are facing more risks than what we face, because at least, you know, we can stay at work, we, you know, not leave outside. But there's others that who face problems, IEDs, VPIDs, car bomb, you know, different kind of problems that Iraq is facing nowadays.
We're speaking with Salim Amir, a member of NPR's Iraqi staff in Baghdad. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Salim, it's been 4 years since the invasion of Iraq. The anniversary comes up next week. Tell us, what's life like today in your neighborhood?
Well, my neighborhood, well known as a mixed neighborhood, it have Shia, Sunni, and Christian. 2 months ago, the Mehdi's militia took over the neighborhood. They start killing the Sunnis and pushing them out of the neighborhood. I think when the security plan started, they stopped, you know, they disappeared. The Mehdi's militia disappeared. Now we have Umar Brigade, a Sunni insurgency group that's running in the neighborhood. We have Afghanis supporting Umar Brigade on fighting the Americans and fighting the Iraqi military and kicking out Shia of the neighborhood. So This is you know, we get tired of sneaking out in and out the neighborhood.
Is it possible for you to go about your daily life? I mean, obviously you're there at work, but is it possible for you to go shopping in your neighborhood? What's your commute like every day to get to work?
Well, first of all, we limit the times of going out to shop instead of going every day or every 2 days. Now we make it like every week or 10 days. Just go once, pick up the stuff that you want and get back. You know, prepare a list for a whole week or 10 days. And, you know, we sneak out. You know, we like thieves, you know, leaving our neighborhood. We have sometimes fake IDs with us saying that we are Sunnis. You know, I'm a Shia. So we have fake IDs saying that we are Sunnis instead. Or sometimes, you know, having IDs have a Christian. So you just can't avoid the sectarian checkpoints that on the way.
If you make a mistake and pull out the wrong ID, you could be in serious trouble.
Yes, you obviously dead and thrown on the street and nobody will care. You know, the Iraqi army checkpoints, the Iraqi forces checkpoints, meters, you know, 100 meters away from the insurgents checkpoints, but they are doing nothing.
You have a son now. You have family obligations. You have obligations, obviously, to your larger family. Do you feel that there is an Iraqi state to which you have an obligation?
No, there isn't. You know, we are not living in a country. We are just living. It's not a war zone. We are living on just, you know, just ground that have people fighting. You know, they just want chairs. They just want money. They just want their own interest. But the regular people, you know, they're not facing. You know, we died. You know, Iraqis died every day.
In that clip of tape where we just heard from you, you were talking about the future and how brief you saw the future as being, that a month from now is almost an eternity. As you look at the situation there, and again, thinking about the life of your young son, how do you see the future?
You know, the future is so black, so bad. I guess a month from now, most likely, or I will stuck at work, you know, I can't get back to home, or I just gonna sit at home doing nothing, or we just gonna move out of from the house. This is what we are facing. You know, every day it's going worse. We have security plan promises, we have American promises, we have Iraqi promise, a lot of things, but nothing get achieved yet. You know, I couldn't even see, you know, a small change from the security plan. People are still dying. I can't see that every day.
So there's no change whatsoever from your point of view?
Yeah, you know, there is no change at all. You know, it's still the same. You know, Iraqis nowadays, and you know, the people that I know, I'm talking about Shia. They wish that they can get back to Saddam Hussein time.
They wish they could get back to Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, of course.
Yeah, you know, they want peaceful life. You know, they just want to live peacefully. They don't want government. They don't want something special as a Shia. The Sunnis have the same fear too. You know, they just want to get back. You know, we don't want. You know, we don't need the technology. We don't want America. This is how Iraq is feeling nowadays.
Salim Amir, thanks very much for staying up again to speak with us. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And we wish you and your family the best and hope you stay safe there in Baghdad. And congratulations again on the birth of your son. We'd like to thank the staff here at WCPN for their assistance with our broadcast. Dave Kanzig, David Mulpas, Bill Rice, David C. Barnett, Jeff Carlton, and Tasha Flournoy. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday, and Ira Flatow will be here. We'll be back in Washington on Monday. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Cleveland.